Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Taylor Jones. She's the Endangered Species Advocate for Wild Earth Guardians, a Western conservation group. She has a master's degree in conservation biology and sustainable development from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is dedicated to preserving the incredible life forms on planet Earth. Today we talk about Joshua trees. So first off, thank you for all your incredible work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Happy to be here.
So who or what, who and what are Joshua trees?
Joshua trees are one of my favorite southwestern plants. They're a type of yucca, and they live in Nevada, Utah, California, and Arizona, right where those four states come together. They're most well known from Joshua Tree National Park, which, if any of you listening have been out there, will know looks very strange. It's a Martian landscape. It's quite wonderful. Joshua trees look like something out of Dr. Seuss. They're very oddly branched. They have spiky leaves. Their silhouettes are very iconic when talking about Joshua Tree National Park in particular and on the Southwest in general. So Joshua trees are a big part of the Southwestern community in terms of providing habitat for other insects or birds that build their nests on Joshua trees, or lizards, or numerous species of rodents.
So how big do they get? How fast or slow do they grow? And how long do they live? And then after that, I'm going to ask you, what was their range prior to conquest? And also, what is their, you've talked about their current range, and are they doing well or are they doing poorly? So it's like seven or eight questions at once. And you can go in any order you want.
Okay. So they're very, very slow growing. Grow just a few inches a year, usually. And they can grow up to 70 feet tall. That's the extreme end of the spectrum. They're usually about, usually the maximum is about 40 feet. And they're extremely long-lived. Some are estimated to be over 300 years old. They're probably some of the oldest living things in the southwestern desert. And in terms of their range, that's an interesting question because it's changed a lot since the Holocene. And we look at geologic time when considering expansion and contraction of Joshua tree range because they are so long-lived. And their generation time is about 70 years. Meaning that it takes a very long time for their range to expand and contract. And I can talk about this in a lot more detail.
Wait, when you say a generation time of 70 years, do you mean that it takes them 70 years to become sexually adults? To become reproductive?
70 years, yeah, to become sexually mature and then reproduce.
Okay. Before we go on to threats, isn't there something about how the Joshua trees are still mourning the loss of sloth bears? Is that true? That they had a relationship with them? Or ground sloths, I mean?
Yeah, so one theory about Joshua tree seed dispersal was that the seeds were dispersed by the now extinct ground sloth. That theory, it may or may not be true. There's some evidence that ground sloth definitely ate Joshua tree fruits and seeds. But it's a little harder to determine if they actually dispersed Joshua tree seeds. A lot of the seeds that are found in ground sloth remains are have been damaged. So the gut of the ground sloth may have been pretty hard on Joshua Tree seeds. The most likely mechanism, both historically and in the present, for dispersal of Joshua Tree seeds is various rodents taking the seeds and caching them for the future. So this is a very important point about Joshua trees and one of the reasons why it is so hard for them to disperse. If you shift their range, is because the only way that they can move around is by being carried by rodents, having their seeds carried by ground squirrels or various other kangaroo rats, other rodents.
And the reason... And the reason that's limiting is that if a bird eats them, a bird can fly 10 miles and poop. Or if a bear eats them, a bear could go 10 miles and poop. But if a kangaroo rat eats them, it can only go 100 yards and poop. Is that why?
Well, they don't really survive going through the digestive system of most animals.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right, gotcha.
It's difficult for them to be dispersed in that way. They're usually dispersed because the animal will carry the seed whole and bury it to save it for later, and then either forget about it or find something else to eat and leave the seed buried underground, where if conditions are right, it will eventually germinate.
And the point is that a kangaroo rat is not going to carry the seed for 17 miles before it buries it. It's going to carry it for just a little ways, so that's why they have such a hard time moving quickly.
Exactly. It's a pretty short distance, that the average dispersal distance of Joshua trees. It's estimated to be about 2 meters a year. At the species level that their range shifts. And that's based on information from the fossil record.
And let's contrast that really quickly. I don't know what dispersal ranges are for a lot of species, but I do remember I was in, northwestern Illinois, and a rehabilitation person, a wildlands rehabilitation person there, was talking to me, and he gave the figure of the deciduous trees in that region can disperse up to about 30 feet per year. And that's just one sample size, but I'm just saying that in terms of contrasting what is a faster dispersal for whatever species it was he was talking about with the Joshua tree.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the slower dispersing plants.
And
one of the slower dispersing plants.
And why is this important to us right now, the fact that it's slow dispersing?
It's important because climate change is projected to shift the range of Joshua trees, and the estimate is large areas of the globe are going to require migration rates of up to 1,000 meters a year for plants to keep up with the range shifts. So as the climate warms, the envelope in which Joshua trees can live is going to move, but the Joshua tree might not be able to move fast enough to keep up because the rate at which that envelope shifts, it's going to be much faster than the rate at which they can actually migrate. And that includes models that projected a migration rate of up to 22, or between 22 and 33 meters a year. That was a purposefully extremely optimistic projection, just so the migration would actually show up on the model that they were using. But even with that very optimistic, fast migration rate, they didn't keep up with the shifting climate.
So before we talk more about the ramifications of what you just said. Let's back up a little bit more and talk about, you know, you mentioned Joshua trees being food for various species. Can you talk more about the importance of Joshua trees for the biomes of whom or which they are a member?
Sure. So Joshua trees are one of the few shade trees in the Southwest. There's this quote from a 1971 article that I really like that says it is a very useful tree in the all-embracing plan of nature, which I thought was very poetic. They are a source of food for lots of different rodents and birds. They are a source of habitat for birds in particular, and also for lizards. There's one species of night lizard that shelters under the bark and eats insects that live in the Joshua tree. And most specifically, the Joshua tree has co-evolved with a pollinator. Like most members of the yucca family, Joshua trees are entirely dependent on a yucca moth that has evolved specifically to pollinate the Joshua tree. So how it works is this moth goes from flower to flower and purposefully pollinates the flower, lays its eggs inside the flower, and then the larva of the moth eat the seeds. So it's in the interest of the moth to pollinate the flower in order that its larva will have a food source. And it's in the interest of the Joshua tree to produce food for the moth so that it gets pollinated. So there's this very delicate balancing act between the moth and the Joshua tree. And now there's two subspecies of Joshua tree, and they each have a specific moth that pollinates just that tree. So if the Joshua tree were to disappear, these moths would disappear as well, because they're entirely dependent on each other. And the reverse is also true. If those moth species were to disappear for some reason, the Joshua tree would have a very difficult time getting pollinated and would probably disappear as well. So that's the closest tie between the Joshua tree and other species in the ecosystem.
And you said earlier that the kangaroo rats, et cetera, will catch the seeds. And is there a fruit associated with the seed, or is it a seed by itself?
There is a fruit associated with the seed. They make sort of a hard ball that has seeds in the middle. And during its period of peak ripeness, there's a little bit of fruit on the outside of that seed that has a high sugar content, but generally species that are eating this fruit are going for the seeds that are in the middle and not for the fruit itself. And there's actually, the fruit doesn't naturally open on its own. The only way that it will pop open is if a mammal of some sort breaks it open.
Can that be a time?
So it appears that your
I was going to say, a tiny mammal like a kangaroo rat, or does it have to be a bigger mammal? That's all.
No, it's usually a small mammal.
So you started to say it appears that.
So it appears that rodents are very necessary in the life cycle of the Joshua tree. And there's quite a few species that feed on and cache the seeds. There's white-tailed antelope squirrels, Merriam's kangaroo rats specifically, canyon mice, Mojave ground squirrels, and California ground squirrels are the ones that have been recorded feeding on and catching the seeds.
And am I wrong, or are kangaroo rats in trouble too? Is it only some species of kangaroo rats, or generally?
I believe it's just some species of kangaroo rat, and I couldn't tell you off the top of my head which ones are in trouble and which ones are doing okay. But yes, some of them are definitely in trouble. I know the Texas kangaroo rat in particular, that's one that I know is in trouble.
So are there... I still want to hold off on talking about global warming for a while longer. Are there other threats to Joshua trees besides global warming?
Mm-hmm. So global warming definitely interacts with a lot of other threats. One is, so it's hard to tease all of the threats apart because they all interact and build upon each other. But one big problem is the combination of invasive plants and higher incidence of fire, because there's this invasive grass, red brome, that very easily spreads fire, and that's not normal in this ecosystem. And the brome grows very rapidly during periods of high precipitation, lots of rain, and then dries out very rapidly and then catches on fire quite easily. And so periods of high precipitation are also when baby Joshua trees are germinating and have the best chance of actually germinating and growing into adult Joshua trees. However, you have all of this dry brome that catches on fire, and that fire, the young Joshua trees are very vulnerable to that. So it's sort of this perfect storm of an invasive grass, higher incidence of drought, higher incidences of fire. The grass has changed the fire regime, causes it to be much more frequent in this ecosystem than it normally is, and that has a big impact upon Joshua tree recruitment because it really impacts the young trees. And the older trees are also vulnerable to fire. Their chances of survival decreases a lot after they've been burned, even if they initially survive the fire damage that's done, decreases their chances of survival in the future.
There are plenty
so
of...
that's one...
Sorry, go ahead.
That's one threat. Another is pollution. Interestingly, this interacts with the brome. There are... the pollution from particularly Los Angeles blows over the desert and deposits nitrogen, and that fertilizes non-native plants. And it's much better for them than it is for native plants. They take it up faster and grow faster than native plants. So that interacts with this changing fire regime issue. And that it's harder to make a connection there, but there are definitely some studies showing that increased nitrogen is much worse for native plants than it is for non-native plants.
I was going to ask a minute ago that we've all seen places that because of grazing or whatever, there is a lack of recruitment of, for example, cottonwood trees or trees of any sort. Is it noticeable when you walk through a Joshua tree, an area with Joshua, what do we call it? Do we call it a forest? Do we call it a desert with Joshua trees? What do we, if you walk through a group of Joshua trees or an area with Joshua mm-hmm. trees, do you see noticeably less recruitment? Is that visible to the normal eye that you see a lot less babies than you should?
Well, in some areas that has been noted by researchers that there's a lack of recruitment. Some areas there is better recruitment, like in Refugia within Joshua Tree National Park. There are some areas where recruitment is pretty good. But it's hard for humans to see things at Joshua Tree timescales. I think often it's hard to tell if recruitment is more or less than it should be, because they recruit in pulses of about 10 years at some time. So you may not see young Joshua trees for decades, and that might be perfectly normal. And, or you could get a recruitment pulse and see lots of Joshua, small Joshua trees. And that's because a lot of different factors have to come together in just the right way for Joshua trees to successfully reproduce. There has to be the right amount of rain, both during the seed-producing period and during the germination period. There has to be a cold snap once the young trees have grown to a certain age that helps them reach their full growth potential. There has to be the right temperature range. So a lot of different factors have to come together. So the yucca moss, the rodents that catch the seeds, Joshua trees are also very much helped by what are called nurse plants, which are simply plants that create microclimates that are a little cooler, a little wetter, so that Joshua tree seedlings are slightly buffered from this harsh environment while they're growing their large root systems and getting established. So a lucky Joshua tree seed will get cached by a rodent under a nurse plant, and that dramatically increases its chances of survival. Now, these rodents obviously don't know this, and they don't purposefully cache Joshua tree seeds under nurse plants, so it's completely random whether or not this will happen, and it's just luck. So you need a lot of luck to be a Joshua tree that survives.
So what are there other threats to them, as well as the invasive species and the pollution leading to increased nitrogen? The one I'm thinking of, and I'm sure there may be others too, but the one I'm thinking of, and this is just perhaps shows my hatred of off-road vehicles. Are off-road vehicles a problem for them?
Not that I know of.
Oh, damn, I can't blame them for that then.
Yeah, fortunately, human vandalism, while occasionally cropping up, is pretty rare. I mean, you may have heard of graffiti that happened in Joshua Tree National Park, or people potentially going out just collecting Joshua trees for ornamental plants. I don't know if that even works. I wouldn't recommend it for obvious reasons. But those sorts of instances are pretty rare. And so that's one thing, fortunately, that Joshua trees don't have to worry about too much.
So are there any other major threats that you know of?
Let me think. The major threats are mostly climate change related. There's very little collection of Joshua trees. There's very little disease that impacts them. There may be a certain amount of seed predation, and sometimes jackrabbits will eat the young Joshua trees during periods of drought. But mainly the threats are habitat loss, and that's climate change caused, and is caused by those invasive species that I was talking about. Just the major threats are habitat loss and climate change.
Well, before we get to climate change, I just want to ask one thing about habitat loss. Is there significant habitat loss due to so-called development? I mean, losing habitat to cities or anything else, or is that actually not a problem?
Well, I wouldn't say it's not a problem, but it's definitely not as big of a problem for Joshua trees as it is for some species. There's very little development in Joshua tree habitats at the moment, though that may change if there's considerable growth in certain areas. We are concerned about human population growth, which is projected to rise quite a bit in the area, and I'm looking for the exact number right now. But that would cause considerable pressure on the resources in the area, particularly water resources. So that could be definitely a problem. Yeah, so the population of the Southwest is expected to increase from 56 million to 94 million by 2050. So that's quite an increase.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so even in these resource-limited areas, population growth is expected to be quite high. And that's going to put pressure on resources in the area. And so looking into the future, we just don't know how development is going to impact Joshua trees. Desert solar may become a problem. Urban sprawl may become a problem. There's definitely potential for that to be a big problem. And also fragmentation of landscapes with roads and development. While it may not impact Joshua trees directly, it impacts their ability to move from place to place. And so they already have this problem where they're very slow dispersers. And if there's a barrier in the way, then that will completely cut off any chance of them moving from one habitat to a more favorable area.
Well, if a kangaroo rat has to disperse the seeds, and they disperse, I think you said, 2 meters a year, and you have a four-lane interstate, that's a lot of ground for kangaroo rats to cover.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got a mode, you've got a mode median. Sorry, go ahead.
It's probably not going to make it across the highway.
Plus you've got the mode area at the side and the mode median. That's a long distance for it to cover. So let's talk about the lawsuit. The Wild Earth Guardians, what is the relationship between Wild Earth Guardians and Joshua trees?
So we petitioned the Joshua tree to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, and that means we wrote an extensive, scientifically based document explaining the threats to the Joshua tree. It was backed up with numerous studies about 5 or 6 climate models, specifically modeling how Joshua tree range was going to be impacted by climate, information about all of the other threats, and we compiled all of this information into an approximately 50-page document and sent that to the Fish and Wildlife Service and asked them, hey, take a look at this. We think the Joshua tree should be listed as threatened because all of these climate models project that its habitat is going to diminish by about 90% in the next 100 years. And we have to, like I said, we have to think on a geologic time scale for Joshua trees. So if we wait any longer, by the time we get around to protecting them, they're not going to be creating baby Joshua trees anymore because the climate's going to have changed too much for them to survive. So we need to do this now. We need to look down the road and say, in 100 years, Joshua trees are going to be gone. So we sent that petition to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and now we're awaiting a response they technically had 90 days to respond to the petition, but they have not yet. And because of other legal settlements that we're in with the agency, we can't sue over that missed deadline, but we're hoping that they expeditiously finish their review of the Joshua Tree and give us a decision one way or another. And that will probably happen over the next couple of years.
So I'm sorry if this is a terribly ignorant question, but is this the first being mm-hmm. for whom you have filed who's almost exclusively threatened by global warming as opposed to other threats? When we think about mm-hmm. endangered species, oftentimes it is because of habitat loss, it's because there are dams on the river that don't allow salmon to swim up. Is this the first one that you have petitioned, or were there pika before, or is this the first of a group of a half mm-hmm. dozen, or what?
So, it's not the first. The first species we petitioned that was almost, it lives in a national park only. So, climate change is really the only threat. It's called the meltwater Lednian stonefly, or the mist forest fly, and it's completely dependent on runoff from glaciers. And Glacier National Park is projected to lose all their glaciers by 2030 because of climate change. So that species, the stonefly, is now a candidate for listing, which unfortunately doesn't provide it any legal protection. But the Fish and Wildlife Service did find it warranted for listing based on the threat of climate change. They just haven't actually listed it yet. They put it on the waiting list. So there's some other species in the works that are threatened by climate change. I mean, the most iconic is the polar bear. But Fish and Wildlife managed to avoid addressing climate change in regards to the polar bear by citing other threats. And if I can get technical for a second, the Endangered Species Act, you can list the species as endangered, and that means that it's in danger of extinction, or you can list it as threatened, which means that it's in danger of becoming endangered within the foreseeable future. So, when you list something as threatened, the Fish and Wildlife Service can write what's called a 4D rule, which allows some exceptions to the protections of the Endangered Species Act. So they wrote a 4D rule for the polar bear that exempted climate change, basically. We are hoping that the more species come in front of Fish and Wildlife Service that are primarily or only threatened by climate change, that they'll have to rethink that decision and their reluctance to address climate change and actually take on that problem, because the amount of species that are going to come in front of them because of climate change, it's only going to increase.
Okay, so go ahead, please.
So up to now, the service has not used the Endangered Species Act as a tool to combat climate change, but we're hoping that as more species come in front of them, they will step up to the plate and take more concrete action. For example, the Interior Department and Fish and Wildlife Service, part of the Interior Department, continue to lease public land for coal extraction and for fracking and for oil and gas development. And if Interior were serious about preventing climate change to save species like the polar bear and the meltwater lemming and stonefly and the Joshua tree, then they would keep those fossil fuels in the ground on public land.
So I'm gonna ask something, and I mean, you know that I'm completely on your side with this. I'm just trying to think my way through that. I understand with a lot of times with the Endangered Species Act that if you have a specific tiger salamander, for example, who is endangered, that one of the things you do is you create a bunch of habitat or you set aside habitat so that that specific tiger salamander can continue, or kangaroo rat, or whomever we're talking about. I think we all understand how the Endangered Species Act works on that level. But it seems to mm-hmm. me that when you're talking about global warming, if I were in the Fish and Wildlife Service, I would be pulling my hair out because, yeah, we can try to keep that coal in the land, but there's still the coal in China. There are external threats that make global warming much larger and much more difficult to solve than setting aside habitat and stopping people from trapping or stopping people from using a specific pesticide or something. Do you see what I'm getting at? This is like opening up a huge door, which I think is great. It's a whole, this seems to me a revolutionary application of the Endangered Species Act process. Am I misreading this?
No, it would be opening up quite a lot of interesting logistical issues. I'm not denying that in any way. But I think it's something that Fish and Wildlife Service does need to grapple with, because there are ways in which the U.S. government is contributing to climate change. And yes, we can't control what is happening in China, but we can control the coal that we're exporting from the United States to China that feeds that demand. We can control the amount of coal that we're digging up out of the ground, for example, in the Powder River Basin, which is one of the largest coal-producing areas in the world. It's on public land in the U.S. And the federal government subsidizes coal without taking into account the damage that climate change causes to our shared environment. So I don't know the answer to how the Fish and Wildlife Service can use the Endangered Species Act to combat climate change. It's a very complex question, but I think it's something that we need to start thinking about. And we want to put pressure on the agency to do just that, because they're in a position within the Interior Department where they might be able to leverage their position within the federal government to start taking into account the environmental costs of coal and oil and gas leasing on public lands.
I think that's all fantastic. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to mention that in the meantime, the Endangered Species Act could really help Joshua trees in particular by preserving refugia in particular. The climate models point out some areas that are going to be suitable habitat for the Joshua tree in the future, and the Endangered Species Act could safeguard critical habitat in those areas and could potentially provide funding for introducing the trees into those new habitats as their current habitat becomes less suitable. So there's other ways that the Endangered Species Act can benefit Joshua trees.
I think all that's fantastic, and given the sometimes reticence on the part of the upper-level fish and wildlife bureaucracy to protect wild animals and wild plants, and that they've had to be forced through lawsuits to do so. I'm kind of smiling at the consternation with which some of the upper-level bureaucrats must be perceiving your petition. I think it puts them in a really difficult position and opens up the big doors that we've just been talking about. I think that's fantastic. But I can imagine that a lot of them are pulling out their hair right now going, what are we supposed to do?
Well, I think that's why the Meltwater Lesbian Stonefly is currently on the candidate list rather than being actually listed, because it is a complicated problem. And unfortunately, the Fish and Wildlife Service often shies away from getting involved in these complicated problems. The most controversial species are often the least likely to get listed. And that includes species that are impacted by climate change. Because, yeah, it speaks to your question. What do you do? How do you use the ESA to combat climate change? I mean, we have to fundamentally change the way that we produce energy in this country, and that's not easy. That's bigger than Fish and Wildlife Service, and they don't necessarily want to engage, but we all have to engage because this is urgent. This is an extinction crisis, and we all need to be grappling with this problem.
So we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and what I guess one of the questions I have first off is, I've got a couple three questions. One of them is, how can people who A, live in the region where Joshua Trees live, and B, those who don't live in those regions, how can they help efforts to protect Joshua Trees?
That's a great question. I'd say if you're local to Joshua Tree habitat, make sure that your community has a sustainable development plan or a cap on development or some way in which the community prevents habitat loss for these desert plants, because we're going to need to preserve as much habitat as possible, because a lot of it is going to get lost in the future because of climate change. And the more that we can save, the better the chances are that Joshua Trees will survive. So I would talk to your local planning council or planning department, and talk to your city council, talk to your neighbors, see what kind of plan your community has in place for development, and whether or not there is provisions for preserving habitat in that plan. As for people that are not in the region, Joshua Trees are a big draw for tourism, and that drives some local economy. So I would support local businesses when you visit Joshua Tree, which you should do because they're amazing and awesome to see. And make sure that the people living in those areas know that you're sort of voting for conservation with your dollar.
Another small question. Go ahead.
And that Joshua Trees are a draw for people to come to the area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A small question. Locally, I live on the coast, on the northern coast of California, and there's a local environmental organization that a couple times a year they will have parties where they go out and pull an invasive beach grass that is harming an endangered native beach grass. And they will Would that be a feasible thing for people who live locally to organize a party to go out and remove the invasive grass from Joshua Tree areas?
That's a good question, and I hesitate to answer that because I'm not an expert on how to get rid of that invasive grass. I actually don't know how easy it is to distinguish it from native grass and whether there are plans in place to remove that invasive grass. But that might be something that people could talk to their local fish and game agency or their local branch of Fish and Wildlife Service about, because that could definitely be helpful. And removing invasive species is always good for native ecosystems. So that might be something that people could do some research on and see if that's something that they could help with.
So one last question. So if you were made the queen of all things Joshua Tree, what would you put in place to help them? What are like the three policy changes you would make? It sounds like you'd stop removing coal in Powder River, or stop removing coal on public lands, let's say. What else would you do to help them?
Yes. I would protect as much current and potential Joshua Tree habitat as possible. And I would make sure that we're doing research into the possibility of translocating Joshua Trees. Because some areas, I think it's inevitable that we're going to lose some habitat, but we may gain some new habitat in other areas as the climate envelope sort of shifts northward. So there may be opportunities to translocate Joshua Tree into those new pockets of habitat where Joshua Tree wouldn't necessarily be able to make it there on its own, but humans with great dispersal capabilities and responsibilities for what's causing Joshua Tree to lose their habitat, it's possible that we could get them new habitat. And I would just like to see that research funded and done really well so that if we are able to do it, we do it right and it doesn't have unintended consequences. But that's something that we should look into just in case we are unable to preserve Joshua Trees in all the places where they exist now. I'm hopeful that if we can, you know, if I was the queen of all things Joshua Tree, then we would be taking much larger steps to halt climate change in its tracks, and therefore we might be able to preserve Joshua Trees where they are, which is really the ideal. So I'm hopeful that will happen, but we need to look into alternatives just in case.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Taylor Jones. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.